Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, we'll talk about the best organic gardening methods on How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and international expert agrohomeopath Kavi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Kavi Raj. She is the vice president of the World Homeopathic Association in the UK chapter and the author of the international bestseller, Homeopathy for Farm and Garden, which has been translated into 7 languages with 12 new language versions in progress now. Today is January 19th, 2011, and you're listening to show number 13 of How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens. Thank you so much for joining me. In addition, you can find Kavi Raj on Facebook. He visits the HWC, the Homeopathy World Community Facebook page, and the Homeopathy World Community social network. He is also to be found on the Homeopaths Daily online newspaper. And I can give you a link for that so that you can read all of his activity on the internet. It's the paper.li/Debbie Bruck/homeopaths. And every single day, there are over 160 homeopaths who are posting via Twitter to the internet onto this online newspaper. So today's show is all about how plants relate to each other. And I am still waiting for Kavi Raj to call into the show. He must be hung up with a patient or something's going on. I'm hoping that he will be able to call in today. If not, we'll play it by ear. So today, the show is really about plants and their means of communication. There's an article on the internet on Earth News that says, plants can recognize themselves, written by Matt Walker. Plants may be able to recognize themselves, and experiments show that a sagebrush plant can recognize a genetically identical cutting growing nearby. What's more, the two clones communicate and cooperate with one another to avoid being eaten by herbivores. The findings published in Ecology Letters raise the tantalizing possibility that plants, just like animals, often prefer to help their relatives over unrelated individuals. It's kind of like preferential behavior. And it's interesting that plants are able to do that. The findings published in Ecology Letters raise the tantalizing possibility that they do actually prefer to help their relatives over their unrelated individuals. The ability to distinguish self from non-self is a vital one in nature. It's just like when infants are born, the child is born, and at first they're still connected to their mother, and they are not able to differentiate themselves from their mother. And then at some point in the stage of development, they do see it's you and me, separate self. So this allows many animals to act preferentially towards others that are genetically related to themselves. For example, a female lion raising her young. or protecting other more distinctly related cubs in her pride. But the evidence that plants can do the same is limited and controversial. So this is where it gets tricky, because we don't think about plants being able to speak like humans, being able to talk with a mouth or signal each other in certain ways or talk to each other. And, you know, we think maybe about animals being able to do that in some way, but not really plants. So this is really going on the edge of thinking. Some experiments have shown that if a plant's roots grow near to those of another unrelated plant, the two will try to compete for nutrients and water. But if a root grows close to another of the same parent plant, the two do not try to compete with one another. This is quite an interesting discovery. However, in these experiments, when cuttings of the same plant are then grown alongside each other, their roots still compete for resources. This implies that two separate plants cannot recognize that they are genetically related, called genetic kin. Now, the research by Richard Carbon of the University of California in Davis, the U.S., and Kaori Shiojiri of Kyoto University in Otsu, Japan, has revealed that some plants are capable of doing just that. And it's not surprising to me that there would be a Japanese researcher, because I always think about how close the Japanese are in their culture to nature and tendering the bonsai tree and really talking to plants. So the plants keep it in the family. They took the cuttings of the Artemisia tridentata, a species of sagebrush that does not normally reproduce by cloning itself. They placed each cutting either near its genetic parent, essentially that's its clone, or near an unrelated sagebrush that's not related in the family, and let the plants grow in the wild in the University of California, Seghen Creek Natural Reserve. The researchers clipped each clone they planted, feigning damage that might be caused by natural herbivores such as grasshoppers. So they made it seem as if they had some natural damage from insects, and after 1 year they found that plants growing alongside their damaged clones suffered 42% less herbivore damage than those growing alongside damaged plants that were unrelated. This is quite interesting that they had a way of protecting themselves, thinking that there might have been insects in the vicinity, in their neighborhood, and they must have signaled these. This is the thinking of the plant researchers. Somehow, the clipped plants appeared to be warning their genetically identical neighbors that an attack was imminent, and the neighbor should somehow try to protect itself. But clipped plants didn't warn unrelated neighbors, which means that they had some way of speaking, communicating, or talking to those plants that were related to them in some way. Carbon says he was pretty surprised at the results. It implies that plants are capable of more sophisticated behavior than we imagined. Carbon suspects the plants are communicating using volatile chemicals. When one plant is clipped or comes under attack from herbivores, it emits these chemicals into the air, warning those around it to put up a defense, either by filling their leaves with noxious chemicals or by physically moving their stems or leaves in some way to make themselves less palatable. So if the plants become less tasty, less desirable by the insects that would normally go after it, they're going to save themselves and be able to continue to grow. This is really interesting way of thinking, because we know ourselves how humans think and relate and behave to, and we continue to study that, how we communicate and how we interrelate in families, in neighborhoods, and in the greater society. But what about plants? They don't have the same type of organs. The organs are a little bit different. and they are not able to move around. So they have developed their own way of communicating. Because his team doesn't yet know exactly how the plants are communicating, they remain skeptical of the research. Carbon admits this. So here you see again, the word skeptic is continually coming up in today's modern world of science because we don't understand it. We don't know how it works. We observe it. We see that it does happen, but we really don't understand it. So therefore, they remain skeptical, which means it's not bad to be skeptical if it means that you're going to keep an open mind and continue to investigate, to learn and understand the phenomena. But you don't deny it outright. You don't say, I can't believe it. It's not possible. So it is possible. And so we have to kind of differentiate this word skeptic and skeptical and who is saying it and what they really mean when they say it. It's controversial, Carbon says, but through this communication process, Sagebrush appears able to distinguish self from non-self, and that opens up a lot of other possibilities. And seems to me that if one plant is able to communicate, do you not think that more than the other plants will also be able to do something like this in their own way? Not least is that wild plants may preferentially be cooperating with their relatives. There is no hard evidence yet to show this is true, says Carbon. But he hopes others will now do more research to investigate the possibility. So that is what I think. I think we have a caller coming in.
So, this is Dr. Brock here.
Hi, it's nice to have you here. I think Kaviraj has disappeared today. He must be busy with something and is not able to call in. But we are talking about this phenomenal research that's being done about plants being able to communicate. Do you have something to add?
Well, it's kind of intriguing what I'm trying to figure out. And there's a number of different articles that are out there. Is the exact mechanism by which they do it. It almost seems to be on an energy level that they're able to do it. Certainly there are certain biochemicals involved, but the plants seem to be able to recognize not only similar plants within their own species, but also invasive plants that come into their root zone or their area that they're living and react, actually, to their presence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they do that to protect themselves, and I don't know what it is, what all the areas of communication they might have. For instance, definitely we're learning about invasion from insects. What about if they don't have enough water and there's a drought? How do they communicate that information? Or the difference in temperature, how they protect themselves from the weather? Those are and obviously Kaviraj would talk to us about the cycles of plants and when it's time to flower and bud and pollinate, they're definitely going to be talking to each other. So do you have any comments about that?
Well, I mean, I think the bottom line is that plants obviously are living organisms. They've evolved in such a way that they are going to be involved in self-preservation. That's the basis of all evolution. Otherwise, if it hits a dead end, plants and animals go extinct. So there are a number of different reactions that take place in plants that are, at least by plant scientists, defined as being biochemical reactions. For example, we know that plants that are under stress will do two things. Number one, they're going to emit ethylene gas into their environment, okay, as a deterrent for other plants invading their environment. And the other thing that they will do is literally have what are known as allelochemicals or biochemical, they're not pheromones. Pheromone would be the wrong term. Pheromones are actually produced only by animals and insects. But what they have, plants, are allelochemicals that are basically induced, a hypersensitive reaction. There has to be a reason for it to produce those basic compounds into its environment. And frankly, we don't understand all of those things.
So we're just learning.
Yeah. Additionally, there are things called shock proteins. Plants actually will produce entirely unique sets of proteins in their system when they are invaded by an insect or a parasite, a fungus, a bacterium, that, again, are right on the cutting edge right now of the area of biochemistry called proteomics, studying how that's elicited and what the actual cause and effect of shock proteins are. So unlike human systems, where tremendous amounts of effort have been put in over a century to address the whole questions of immunity in our systems, plants are really brand new in understanding what the significance is, and we're learning more all the time.
That's fascinating. I'm wondering, I'm sure that the medical world researchers are going to want to use this information that they learn. Kaviraj has prepared some more information, and I will go ahead and let you know what he says. He says that recent research has shown that plants chatter and communicate with their community when attacked by disease or pests, which is exactly what you said, and he calls it talking. He says chatter. We read in our introduction about the phenomena and have seen that there are some differences and many similarities with human and animal societies. These phenomena play an important role in understanding how plants relate to each other. We see these same types of relationships between certain remedies, as shown or seen when one remedy antidotes another, or when a remedy is similar in action to another remedy. This is reflected in nature when we see the nettle plant and its antidote growing right next to each other. And this reminds me of when we talked about the world being kind of symbiotic relationships. So it's not haphazard what you see in your garden, what you see in your crop field. There are certain plants that are naturally drawn to each other for some reason. We may not understand all of it why, but it's best to observe.
Well, one of the best examples of that is I take classes down into the Amazon, and in the Amazon there are over 250,000 different plant species, and of course no one is planting them there. They are there and they grow naturally, and one of the things that we study in ecology is the relationships as to why certain plants grow in a given environment. You may come into a one-hectare environment and find literally 300 or 400 different species of higher plants growing there, and they are living together, and they're fine. They're actually doing well, and there's a reason for that, okay? If other plants come in and try to grow and they're not compatible to that particular environment, they're going to be out-competed or actually killed by the allelochemicals in the plants that are already there. So plants actually are selective about who they'll allow in their neighborhood.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, how would we relate that to humans? I mean, does that mean that people can't get along if they're in a certain neighborhood?
The difference between people and plants, I think, are that we have brains, and, I guess humans do secrete chemicals. We secrete pheromones all the time. And that would be a very interesting study to see whether people, for example, of different races actually have different chemicals that would either attract or repel each other. But hopefully we take our intellect into account in accepting the fact that we're all human beings and at least hopefully try to get along with each other. But plants, of course, don't think, and they have evolved into compatible relationships in nature. That's what plant ecology is about. And they will either accept or reject the plants in their environment based on the chemicals that they actually emit into the environment. And it's interesting.
That basically we're saying that plants are growing based on instinct? They're doing all of this, we're observing,
it's based on natural evolution.
Right, but
it's based on Darwinian, basically, selection. Basically, the winners, the most fit plants in their environment survive. But as we see, is that plants, and the Amazon is a perfect example, do not simply say we are going to evolve as an individual species. One of the most famous plots that I take my students to, in a one-hectare area, 2.47 acres, there are over 300 species of higher trees, not just plants, but trees, growing together in that 1 hectare. Mm-hmm. In the United States, you'd be lucky to find 5 different species of trees growing in a hectare. So these trees have evolved there for hundreds of millions of years and obviously find their presence compatible, whereas when an invasive plant comes in, tries to sprout, and tries to grow, that's not accepted in that environment, it will literally be killed.
Well, it will probably be shaded out or crowded out, or in, like
well,
you said,
chemical,
one of, they would
chemical,
emit a chemical.
Shade tolerance and light tolerance is one factor, but I'm talking about where the plants in its environment
right.
will secrete chemicals into the soil and the air and preclude that plant from ever growing there.
Interesting. But okay, but I'm always interested in human nature and the fact that we as one species, Homo sapiens, we should be able to get along on the planet. So I hope we learn more about it from plants, how we can do that. So this is continuation of what Kaviraj has said. He said, when we grow plants either for pleasure or for business, we should imitate nature by applying so small a dose that to elicit a reaction. Samuel Hahnemann stated in Aphorism 275, quote, if we give too strong a dose of a medicine, it must prove injurious by its mere magnitude, unquote. So in comparison, modern agriculture uses massive amounts of pesticides and insecticides, fertilizers to their fields without controlling really over the quantity of the dosage that, I mean, in crude means, yes, they are measuring it and putting out, but in fine doses, as in homeopathic doses, they're unable to make adjustments. So when we use agrohomeopathy, we're able to change the potency, which is a very fine adjustment. So
let me ask a question.
Yeah.
Okay, that sort of intrigues me. I was reading an article the other day where there is actual experimental proof beyond any doubt. We've known about what I'm about to say for decades, but proof that music will either stimulate or repel plant growth, development, fruiting, seed quality, all these things. We all know that music is a sound wave. Okay, that's all it is. I would hate to think that a tomato plant can appreciate Bach versus Beethoven. On the other hand, it can obviously intercept sound waves in its environment. I'm wondering whether homeopathy, which, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but homeopathy being an energy medicine, a resonance medicine, could have a similar effect on plant health, okay, as, again, exposing a plant to given waves through the air.
I don't see why not. You might have noticed, I wanted to actually mention that today, that the first couple of shows that we did, I was testing our introduction music, and I had something a little bit more rock and roll or something that had more of a heavier beat and a lot of excitement to it. And Kaviraj was not pleased. I got to say that. He said, no, I want some classical music because he's very in tune with plants as an agrohomeopath. And so you hear the soothing sound of a violin concerto opening up the show. And I think that he recognizes and is very aware, like in The Secret Life of Plants, that plants do respond to sound and to music, and this has been, I think it has already been tested.
Oh, it has, and that's my point.
I would assume you would know that.
It's been proven that there are different reactions, but again, on the same, I'm trying to think on what level the reaction is taking place. So if homeopathy, if a given remedy is resonating in the environment of that plant, the roots, the leaves, whatever,
right,
could that be a similar mechanism that is going to positively or negatively affect that plant? Then, as we're saying now, proven sound waves will do the equivalent.
Well, it seems to me that waves are what we have a
it's
lot
energy.
Of theories. We have a lot of theories about homeopathy, and they're talking all about nanotechnology, quantum physics, but all energy is not waves in some way. And so plants are, even humans, when we play Mozart, we have knowledge that it improves our brain function. A child will develop better skills with their math and their science and being able to deal with those kinds of areas of development. So, and Kaviraj has told us that plants themselves have a much less, they don't have the same nervous system that humans do. So they have, they relate in a different way, and I guess we just have to continue to investigate. And I'm saying continually we are learning from our environment, we're learning by observation, we're learning from how, from nature and how plants live and communicate with each other. So let me continue on with the information that Kaviraj has provided for us today. Okay, let's see.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so homeopathy is the only system of medicine, he says, where the practitioner has control over the size of the dose. This is a space age, the 21st century, agriculture. It consists of manageable use of possibly poisonous substances as produced in the relationships discovered in nature to imitate as much as possible that natural setting. So I think he's talking about agro-homeopathy here, and
right,
that he's talking about the safe utilization of harmful poisons. And you think about it, we're talking about protection, and we're talking about how the plants themselves emit chemicals to protect themselves, and we utilize that in medicine, in plant pesticides, I believe. And so how does a homeopath do it? Instead of applying unmanageable amounts of poisons, like on the external application in chemical agriculture, homeopathy has transmuted these potentially poisonous substances through the dilution and succussion of remedies. And the external spraying or applying powders of alkaline or acid chemical supplements can actually burn leaves or plants if they're on it, have too much of it.
Of course.
And they change the composition of the soil drastically as well. Whereas homeopathy, when using your homeopathic remedies, the plants, the roots of the plants uptake the amount necessary for Hahnemann's primary and secondary reactions to occur, for the plant to recognize and resonate with that remedy and do what it needs to respond against it, with it and against the natural disease. The plant makes these adjustments necessary to ward off invaders and to take up needed nutrients throughout the soil. Homeopaths can use these poisons safely and appropriately due to their extensive knowledge about relationships in nature and the principle of the minimum dose. That's the beauty of homeopathy. But you have to be recognize and observe what the symptoms are and to be able to select the correct remedy, an appropriate remedy to help that plant heal. Homeopathy is truly integrated approach to garden problems, and in the same way we can call it holistic medicine. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's again, the thing that's still intriguing to me is it seems that plants, being, let's just call them simpler organisms versus animals, are going to be far more attuned to their environment. As we often say in plant science, when a tree, a red spruce tree that's going to grow for 500 years, is placed in the ground or its seed sprouts out of the ground, when it gets too cold, it can't say, take me to Miami. It's stuck
right
there for 500 years. And in other words, if it's there and lives for 500 years, it's a winner in the ecological game. It has been able to survive. Therefore, it seems logical that plants would have evolved a mechanism in which they are not only sensitive to their environment, but can actually be influenced by their environment and manipulate the same. And homeopathy, being an energy medicine, it seems almost logical or intuitive that a plant would react in its environment, either positively or negatively, and of course that's what agro-homeopathy is about, to find positive reactions in plants that are going to help it grow better and have a better yield and better quality. This being, it seems almost more natural that it's going to work in that sense. In other words, a plant can have a effect of its thinking that, oh, that's good medicine for me, a placebo effect, if you will. Plants
mm-hmm.
are not sentient. Plants do not think. Therefore, since they react to the energy fields around them, in the soil, the air, their neighbors, the chemical world that they live in, homeopathy and studying the effects of it seems a very natural conclusion that you can manipulate that system with homeotherapeutics to the advantage of the grower.
Excellent. Well, you know, you just gave a good response to the skeptics, because we're doing lots of plant trials to show and prove that homeopathy does work to help heal plant diseases and plant weaknesses, and therefore, like you said, it cannot have a placebo effect on plants, and therefore, I believe that using plants, it's going to be the inroad to getting homeopathy accepted in the entire medical field.
Yeah, well, I mean, now we're opening up Pandora's box. I think we can all conclude that there are going to be certain people in the medical field that are never going to accept homeopathy, not because they don't believe in it, because it's bad for their pocketbook.
Uh-huh.
That's a reality there. But I think that you're absolutely correct by saying, I mean, these are the jokes I love reading about animals, okay, that vets, okay, shouldn't use homeopathy because the cat knows that you're giving it a pill to make it better. Sorry, but cats don't know anything, okay? Cats know that cats eat. That's it. And
right.
If you happen to make the cat better by putting a homeotherapeutic in its food, that is the furthest thing from a placebo effect as you can get. And mm-hmm. certainly plants, again, do not think. If I have a bug problem and I spray my plant with a homeotherapeutic and the bugs go away, the plant didn't wake up one morning and say, gee, I think I've been sprayed, so I have to get rid of my bugs. But
That's a good way. You're absolutely correct.
You're
sure you don't think that. Okay, so I want to continue on with the reading. So plant relationships. Some plants are genuine companions while others are antagonistic. And you kind of talked about that in your Amazon adventures.
Right, correct.
The same counts for elements, insects, fungi, and allelochemicals, which all
right.
combine to provide a comprehensive picture of the normal environment. This is what Kaviraj says. And when you do purchase his book, Farm and Garden, then you will be seeing that in there he proceeds from the soil and the elements, the soil fungi and the plant excretions. Next, he'll talk about the companion plants, and then finally the insects, because they all have relationships with each other. Each of those are discussed from the point of view of an individual remedy first. followed by a paragraph explaining its place and its function within the community of plants. Thus, the relationships are explained and enable one to understand the role of each one in connection with the remedy under discussion. He then goes on to tell us about the consciousness. He talks about the consciousness of plants. And I'm not sure I understand 100% what he's talking about, but well, I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. Since consciousness lies at the root of all life, from the elemental to the complex, it is with consciousness that we have to approach the growing of crops. Kavi, you know, he's a very spiritual person, and he speaks about the Sanskrit Puranas from the Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist texts. And if you click on all of his links, you're going to find some of that, of his writings. These Puranas, am I sounding it out correctly?
That's correct.
Consist of historical narratives and stories that are told by one person to another of the universe from creation to destruction. Includes the genealogies of kings, heroes, and sages, not sagebrush, and the demigods and descriptions of Hindu cosmology, philosophy, and geography. There's a lot involved. So I was going to ask him to tell about this consciousness in living beings, and he says it comes in four stages. The first stage is the minerals. Consciousness is found in stone and rock, believe it or not. Diamonds are crystals that grow, and there's growth is impossible without consciousness, which is the symptom of life. And then he says this next one is in plants. Consciousness assumes the seedling phase. Also, here the conscious aspect determines growth. Gosh, as I read that, it kind of reminds me what we spoke about a little bit earlier, that defining or understanding between self and other, that the human is born, and there's a period in their life when they do distinguish themselves from another, kind of a consciousness. And so he says that for the plant, it's the seedling phase. And in animals, there's a consciousness is like a fully grown plant before the flowering sets in. Animals have personality and the ability to learn, but not to philosophize or to think abstractly. So this is also similar to what we were just saying. And lastly, the fourth one is in humans. There's a consciousness, it's like the plant in the bud. If humans come to self-realization and unconditional love, the bud begins to bloom. So it sounds to me like Kaviraj is almost a poet, that he is doing a metaphor for consciousness and relating all of the substances in the world to a plant.
Well, to put it in a more modern context, I mean, Kavi obviously is an expert on this stuff.
Okay.
You know, the modern environmental movement, that exists worldwide, often discusses Mother Gaia, G-A-I-A. And Gaia, of course, means the entire planet. And the same philosophies that you were just talking about, coming from the Sanskrit or the Bhagavad Gita, or whatever, discusses the fact that the rocks, the minerals, the air, the soil, and all the organisms that live within is quote-unquote alive. And I think what that's referring to, and I think you're correct in your analysis and what he said, is that we're not talking about alive as in the sense of being sentient. Okay, there are very few sentient organisms. Of course, at the top of that chain, human beings are sentient. Humans can think, they can rationalize, they can change the environment that they're in major ways. On the other hand, all of nature has a certain aliveness to it, the aliveness of creation. And it is reacting within itself and between those different entities. And to metaphysically or theologically talk about that in the sense of being a consciousness, I think is a good metaphor. I think that a lot of people would accept the fact that yes, although a plant does not think and communicate the way we do, it is nevertheless alive. It has evolved for millions of years into the state that it is in, meaning, back to the word I use, it is an evolutionary winner in Mother Gaia.
Right.
It had to learn how to survive, and learning how to survive, particularly within a natural ecosystem, means knowing how to, in quotes, communicate with all the other organisms in that. I was reading an article just a few minutes ago, and it's amazing. Like we think about plant-to-plant communication, plant-to-insect communication. Think
right.
about the soil. The soil, okay, 1 gram of soil can contain over 1 billion different organisms in it, often from 100,000 different species or genera. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And all of those things are acting in the rhizosphere and the rhizoplane. And we know as a fact that roots communicate with those organisms through all kinds of chemical exudates to attract good ones, to repel bad ones. And this is done on a scale that you're talking about, a nanoscale. It's on the molecular scale that, again, it's fascinating. And I want to make a corollary here. That even though we have data to show that this is happening, even though plant scientists like myself know that these reactions are going on, the amount of actual research that goes into it is minuscule, and I think that's
mm-hmm.
worth talking about. In the same way as homeopathy, okay, if I want to make a 10-gallon bucket of a homeopathic remedy and spray it from the advice in Covey's book, it might cost me 3 cents to be able to do it, okay?
Right.
On the other hand, if I want to make a 10-gallon bucket of some specific antifungal compound made by Syngenta or Novartis, it's going to cost me $200 to
right.
make that bucket. So what's happened is that you take a look, you know, at the skewed nature of our science, is that science is run by money. In order to do science, you have to have a grant. You go to a pharmaceutical company or an agricultural chemical producer, and you say, I need $100,000 to be able to work on this new chemical you put out to find out how effective it is. They write you a check. You go to a homeopathic company and say, I want $1.50 in research grants. They'll look at you like you're crazy. They aren't going to give you any money. And hence,
well,
and hence, the bottom line is that even though, I guess what I'm saying here, it's sort of a metaphor, we know all this is taking place. Factual. No question about it. Soil scientists have talked about this for 2 or 3 generations. On the other hand, to actually get the hard data to be able to scientifically describe it, to be blunt, it's few and far between, simply because you have either people that have no interest in doing it, and the major reason why they have no interest in doing it is that either in the private sector, meaning that it's for profit, or the public sector, meaning if you don't get a grant, you don't get tenure, and you don't survive, there's very little interest in pursuing it. Yet, I think the bottom line is there may be solutions, cures, organic, sustainable agriculture techniques out there that are just begging to be found, that will cost practically nothing, and that could be a boon to world agriculture, as you pointed out, considering we are contaminating the living crap out of our environments today and killing people with cancer because of it.
Wow, that was a lot. I would say that it may cost a lot of money to investigate and supposedly prove that the homeopathic remedies are working, and to really have a broader knowledge and information because it's so novel and innovative. And we have so many other years of development of the chemical corporations, but not really any of agro homeopathy.
Well, that's my point. You're talking about billions being poured in by the chemical organizations to have you buy hundreds of billions of dollars worth of chemicals.
Right. So what I'm saying is it may cost a lot of money to do the investigative experiments for homeopathy, but the problem being that the outcome for the investment will be improved environment and improved nature, but there won't be products sold.
That's it.
However,
there'll be an improvement of world agriculture, and it's not going
right.
to cost anybody nothing.
Well, what we'll have is we will have an improvement of the earth, and we will have better fruit, better production, healthier plants, healthier earth, and healthier air. And, you know, we won't have the runoff and the contamination of the environment. So, in other words, what the problem is with these corporations who are in doing the investment, they're not counting in the liability costs. They're not counting in the actual monetary value of the improvement of the earth and the improvement of everybody's health. So that's really not the... Go ahead.
I've worked with these people, and they are not stupid. They know full well what they are doing to the environment. Let me make that clear, okay? But I don't think we should forget, and I have to remind my students of this all the time. If I am a private corporation producing chemicals, I am here to make money and have my stock go up for my stockholders. That
right.
is my motivation. Saving the planet is not my motivation.
Well, I want to bring
this
back to...
That is the disjunct...
Yeah, I
That's
want to bring this back to
the main
theme of the show, which is
yes.
communication. I think we kind of went off on a big tangent there. I would like to continue with communication as the point. So Kaviraj has provided us a epic story as an illustration, and maybe somebody can understand what he is explaining because he kind of thinks at a higher level. He says, there's a conversation that is adapted from the Sanskrit epic story called the Mahabharata. When we hear people say that lower life forms have no soul and thus no consciousness, I think this is kind of a repudiation of that. So he says, the parallels are quite much closer than we may think at first. I mean, what it says in the Human Materia Medica, how can it have any bearing on plant life? And that's one person speaking. And then another person says, by seeing the plant in a similar manner as a human being, the plant has its mouth in the ground. It's the roots. At the junction of root and stem, where the first becomes the latter, we find the heart and the source of the circulation, which brings nitrogen up and sugars down. Digestion, respiration, vision, urinary organs, and sweat glands are all in the leaves. So the plant is like a human being in many respects and suffers from similar diseases and parasites. Then the person replies, I think, next you are going to tell me a plant has consciousness too. Trees have life, but they must be blind, deaf, without smell, taste, and touch. So in response, you talk about the aggregate of the five great creatures, he has that in capital, which create the material world and govern the senses that appertain to it. The Mahabharata illustrates why plants are more like us than you think. King Bharadwaja was asking the sage Bhrishu about the senses and the elements that belong to them. The ear partakes to the element of space, the nose of earth, the tongue of water, the touch of air and wind, and the eyes of life or fire. All creatures, both mobile and immobile, are composed of these five great creatures. So those are the ear, nose, tongue, touch, eyes to hear, smell, taste, touch, and see. That's what he says. So then he goes on. It's kind of a long story. Bharadwaja had his doubts about the veracity of this statement, and asked how come these five elements are not visible in the immobile creatures. Trees don't have any heat in their bodies. They have no motion and are made of dense particles. The five elements are not visible in them. Trees don't see, hear. They have no smell or taste organs and cannot touch anything. Exactly. That's what I think, too. And then the response is, but you know as well as I do that trees do have a lot of space in them in the inter- and intracellular spaces. They always produce leaves, fruits, and flowers. And as a consequence, they have heat in them, too, causing the leaves to drop and later to give you warmth when you burn it in the fire. They also get sick, wither, and dry, showing they have a sense of touch. See what he says? And for how else can disease touch them? From the sound of the wind, the thunder, and the fire, the fruits and leaves drop down so the trees can hear and must have ears. What else to say about this? And so here Kavi is using that same anthropomorphism as what we talked about in the last radio show. People can download that if they wish. And there is the book that I keep mentioning, The Secret Life of Plants, which describes this consciousness.
Right,
it was written in 1973 by Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird. And it was described as a fascinating account of the physical, emotional, and spiritual relations between plants and man. So here there's a response to this by Brighu, one of the characters in this dialogue. He says, a creeper winds its way around a tree, up and up. Even if it has grown a distance away from the tree, it will seek out the tree without fail and then climb up its trunk. Blind things cannot find their way, thus proving the plants have eyes. Also, the leaves and flowers are held so that they follow the sun, catching as much light as they can throughout the day, proving lights that the trees have sight and movement. They put forth flowers in due season as a reaction to certain scents, such as the burning of incense. They drink water by the roots and catch diseases, which can be cured by diverse means. This proves they have taste. They are susceptible to pleasure and pain caused by weather and man in cutting and breaking them, and they will grow anew, showing that they have life. They suck up water and grow and become humid. If there were no water in trees, then why does green wood generally not burn? So you see that also the immobile creatures partake of all the properties of all the five creatures, he calls them. Therefore, I say they are not too much different from humans, although similar states may look very different. This is a free rendering of the arguments put forth by the king and the sage and extended to modern findings such as found in The Secret Life of Plants.
Let me quote something here. It's really interesting that I just found. And it shows you just how old this thing is. And I'm actually looking at his picture. This is an Indian scientist, Sir Jagdish Chandra Bose, B-O-S-E, who lived in New Delhi in the year 1900. Okay, and it's talking about plant communication and plant feelings. Let me read this quickly. One of the first to research the concept of plant sensation is the Indian scientist Sir Jagdish Chandra Bose, who began to conduct experiments on plants in the year 1900. He found that every plant and every part of a plant appears to have a sensitive, quote, nervous system that responded to shock by spasms not different from that of the animal muscles in dogs. One visit to his laboratory, the playwright George Bernard Shaw, famous English playwright, was intensely disturbed upon witnessing a demonstration in which a cabbage had violent convulsions as it was, quote, boiled to death. Bose found that the effects of manures, drugs, and poisons could be determined within minutes, providing plant control for diseases and insect infestation with new precision. In addition, Bose found that plants grew more quickly among pleasant music and slowly among loud, harsh sounds. He also claims that plants could, quote, feel, unquote, and understand pain and affection from an analysis of cell membrane potentials in plants under a different set of environmental circumstances. So, you know, it's interesting. There's nothing new about this idea that plants, which everybody would agree are living organisms, are reacting and are aware, and I again put that in quotes, of its environment. And hence, we get to the reality that if indeed homeopathy is an energy medicine that is inducing a certain response in living systems, it only makes sense that homeopathy would have an effect. And of course, finding out which homeopathic remedy is associated with which plant and which cure seems like a very, very fertile area for research to go on.
Well, you've hit upon an important thing a couple of times during our session today, and that is that homeopaths have learned that the plants are the most sensitive because they can't move about. Insects can move about, animals can move about, humans can move about. And so, therefore, the plants are so much sensitive to the environment that when an individual has a disorder, a dysfunction, they're ill or they've been hurt, that it comes, what comes to the rescue? It's the plant remedies, the families that are in the plant remedies. We know of arnica as our number one remedy for bruising, injury, black and blue, contusions. And then calendula is for scrapes and healing the dermis and the skin and helping that to soothe those irritations. We know of aconite for shock, for when there's cold weather, when you go outside and all of a sudden you're hit by cold weather and then that night you come down with a fever and you really are not well. Aconite comes into play, and hypericum for damage to the nerves. That's St. John's wort. I mean, the list could go on and on, but it's the remedies that why the plants are so hypersensitive to their environment, and thus we as humans also have our hypersensitivity, and the plants are the remedies that come to our rescue. Well, we have 1 minute left, and I'm hoping that Kaviraj will come to our rescue on our next show. He'll be able to come in on time when we start at our usual 12 o'clock hour, and that he will finish up and have his input into this wonderful, mysterious world, the secret life of plants and the way they communicate. And Rob, I want to thank you so much for calling in today. I love you, and
I love you too. It's my job.
You are a plant doctor. And I'm so appreciative that you did come in to my rescue today. We're going to close the show now with some nice music. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-hosts Kaviraj Vaikuthanath and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your garden.